dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week I'm going to play you portions of a panel from a conference, Freedoms at Risk, that was held at New York University in February. The topics raised were timely: issues of academic freedom to criticize establishment views from within the academy, as well as in the press and in the street, and the integrity of the election process itself. The first speaker we'll hear from is Norman Finkelstein, a political scientist whose writings focus on the Israel-Palestine conflict and how anti-Semitism and the Holocaust are used to channel public dialogue and policy on the issue of Zionism. His books include Beyond Chutzpah and The Holocaust Industry. Amidst considerable public debate, Finkelstein was denied tenure at DePaul University in June 2007 and placed on administrative leave. Among the controversial aspects of this decision were attempts by Alan Dershowitz, a notable opponent of Finkelstein's, to derail his tenure bid. Finkelstein opens his talk by making reference to the remarks of the previous speaker, who discussed the firing by the University of Colorado of Native American scholar Ward Churchill as a result of right-wing pressure mounted because of Churchill's statements that rejected the mainstream narrative of 9/11, that of Americans as innocent victims of fanatic Arab terrorists. Churchill's view was that American foreign policy and conduct in the Middle East would have made such an attack justified, and that the corporations housed in the World Trade Center were the enablers or instigators of American imperial aggression. Because Churchill had tenure, he could only be dismissed on grounds of misconduct. The justification finally found for his dismissal was alleged errors of scholarship. Finkelstein disagrees with comments made by the previous speaker on the accuracy of Churchill's scholarship. Here's Dr. Norman Finkelstein.
Well, I regret that Ellen has to leave early because I would like to have had an exchange with her on some of her comments. I'm no partisan nor anti-war Churchill. I just read through the documents. There was a report issued by what was alleged to be an independent committee on Churchill's scholarship. The report was about 120 pages. I went through it quite carefully. I have to say, after reading the report, I walked away with a much higher impression of his scholarship than when I walked in. I'm serious about that. I was quite surprised. They said he had written 40 books, which is a quite impressive output, but I'm aware that sometimes those 40 books can be 40 comic books. So I was naturally skeptical. They went through what they called five of his most egregious, his most outrageous misrepresentations or academic misdemeanors. Of the five they went through, five or six, there was only one, in my opinion, that carried any weight. I think it was a clear error or misrepresentation. and he ought to have accepted responsibility for it. But one egregious, let's call it, error from 40 books which have been combed by leading scholars, I think it's a quite impressive record. So I don't think that particular report proved the case against Professor Churchill. Secondly, I don't like to be dogmatic on these particular issues that we're discussing this evening. I think one of the reasons the campaign, I wouldn't call it a campaign, the criticism of higher education has had some public resonance, one of the reasons is because I think a lot of the criticism is valid. I read that unspeakable, unreadable prose that's put out by a large section of the humanities. I think it is revolting, unreadable. It's like chewing tinfoil with a mouthful of cavities. And it is deserving of being criticized. And it's often, and perhaps even always, simply a smokescreen for hollow scholarship. There's nothing there except polysyllabic verbiage. So I think we have to be aware that one of the reasons we may be vulnerable is because we deserve to be vulnerable. That's part of being honest in these matters, and I think we ought to be. I'm not saying that's the main reason that the universities are under assault, but I think it's a valid criticism of academic life. Having said that, I'll just move on now to my own remarks, again expressing my regret that Alan Trecker won't be here to engage in a dialogue with me, with us, I should say. I think that there are two aspects of the current campaign against higher education. One is the politicized, or formerly political criticism, what can be called a McCarthyism. But the second aspect is, I think as Ellen correctly pointed out, there's a criticism being leveled about the civility of academics. And I said during my own particular case, about which I don't want to dwell at all, but during my own particular case, I used to say, I wish I had been a victim of McCarthyism, and I wasn't trying to be ironic or coy. I honestly did wish I had been a victim of McCarthyism, because at least there would have been an argument about ideas and politics. Whereas in my own particular case, it rapidly degenerated into an ad hominem personal assault on myself and my late family. And at that point, it became, in my opinion at any rate, devoid of any politics whatsoever, and it just became a pissing contest. But I do want to look at that general issue of civility in academic life. And the most famous case I'm aware of in the United States on this whole issue of the conduct or values of a professor came up in 1940 in our own city of New York. Bertrand Russell, the great philosopher, he had won an academic appointment at the City College of New York. And as you can imagine, the administrators at City College, or I should say the faculty, was euphoric. They called it the educational coup of the century, getting Bertrand Russell to teach at City College. But immediately as he got his appointment, he came under attack, or I should say the university came under attack by the Catholic Church of New York because of his writings on morality and sexuality and religion. And a lawsuit was filed against the city of New York protesting Russell's appointment. And he was accused of being in the lawsuit, and now I quote from it, Russell in this case, he was accused of being lecherous, libidinous, lustful, venerous, erotomaniac, aphrodisiac, irreverent, narrow-minded, untruthful, and bereft of moral fiber. Well, in less polysyllabic language, he was accused of being a pervert. And it became a quite famous case in New York's history. I should say that for those of you who have warm memories of LaGuardia, he came out against Russell's appointment. In any event, when Russell himself was called upon to give his opinion on the lawsuit, he wrote to the New York Times as follows. This was his defense. He said, "I claim two things. One, that appointments to academic posts should be made by people with some competence to judge a man's technical qualifications. As Alan Schrecker put it, you don't want your accountant judging the professional competence of your physician, and you don't want Mr. Huckabee to be judging the professional competence of those who teach earth science." And secondly, Russell said that in extra professional hours, a teacher should be free to express his opinions, whatever they may be. Or, as he put it later in a letter, "In a democracy, it is necessary that people should learn to endure having their sentiments outraged." That was his defense against the New York Times, which, like LaGuardia, came out against Russell. Well, in my own opinion, and perhaps I'll sound a little bit conservative on this point, I don't think Russell is right. I don't think he's right when he says a teacher should be free to express his opinions, whatever they may be, outside the classroom, of course. And the reason I don't agree is I think it was put nicely by a school administrator, somebody who's not well known, but seemed to me to have the wisdom and common sense that's sometimes needed to examine questions of this sort. A fellow named Carlton Washburn, addressing the Russell case, he wrote as follows. "Should a professor limit himself or be limited? The strongest advocates of academic freedom are likely to say no. Such absolutism, however, is theoretical. It's not realistic. As a reduction ad absurdum, think of trying to retain on any faculty teachers who openly advocate homosexuality or the assassination of the president. There is always a limit. Of course, in some universities today, you have to advocate those things to get tenure, but this was a different time. The teacher who thinks that this limit does not apply to him is not facing reality. The administrator must necessarily take this fact into account in employing and retaining faculty members. He must recognize that neither students nor the public will segregate a man's teachings in one field from his general teachings, his statements in class from his public pronouncements, his philosophy from his life. He must recognize that, whether or not it ought to be so, students and public consider that the appointment of a teacher places a stamp of approval on him as a whole." I think that's true. When you get appointed as a professor, it is giving you an element of legitimacy. It invests him with a prestige, which seems to justify youth in considering him an example whom it might be well to follow. I think that's true. When you get appointed to a position as a teacher, a message is being transmitted to the students. This is a person who's a model worth emulating. The teacher must be considered in his entirety. This does not mean that he must be a plaster saint, but it means that his assets must clearly outweigh his liabilities. I think, speaking not theoretically, but realistically, those are legitimate concerns. Just the other week, I was speaking at Northridge University in California. A professor took the Russell position, expressed his views, whatever they may be. I said, I don't think you really believe that. He says, no, I do believe that. I said, really? And this was a white professor who happened to have an African-American son. I said, if a professor went on radio and said all black people should be lynched, would you want him to teach your son in class? Well, all of a sudden, he said, of course not. And I think that's exactly right. I think the position of Washburn, the administrator, is right. And Mr. Russell's position, you can't help but admire him, but I think it's wrong. I agree with Washburn's statement of the problem, the honest, realistic question then being, what are the proper limits of civility outside the classroom? Now, let me first make one long caveat. I am speaking about outside the classroom. Inside the classroom, I am very conservative. I'm not just conservative. A lectern is not a soapbox, and you are not there to proselytize, propagandize, or indoctrinate. Your job in the classroom is to stimulate students to think, not to convince them of the right point of view. It's very different than when you're invited to give a public talk. When you're invited to give a public talk, you're being invited because people want to hear your point of view. When you're teaching in a classroom, people are not taking your course because they want to hear your point of view. They're taking your course in order to be stimulated to think about the problem. Anyone with a moment's common sense understands the distinction. It's the distinction between the news pages of a newspaper and the editorial page of a newspaper, or what should be the distinction. The news pages provide you with the facts to make your own judgment. You turn to the editorial page in order to hear what their opinion is. It's the same distinction between what goes on in the classroom and what goes on when you are in your public life as a stupid expression that's used, a public intellectual. So, I am just going to address now the public life. What are the limits to civility in public life? And I'll just go through what to me seem to be some fairly straightforward examples. Let's start with statements which have the appearance of incivility, but are nonetheless factually grounded. So let's take the case Alan Nairn, the very brilliant journalist. He goes on Charlie Rose's program. I suspect it's still on. I don't watch TV. Is it still on? Yeah, okay. He goes on Charlie Rose's program opposite Elliot Abrams, who was the Assistant Secretary of State for Latin America during the Reagan years, and he currently handles the Middle East. And he says that Elliot Abrams is a war criminal by the standards of the Nuremberg statutes. And he says it to him to his face. Well, of course, everyone was shocked. That seemed like a very uncivil statement to make, in particular, right to Mr. Abrams' face. Or you have the case of Professor Chomsky, who says that based on the Nuremberg statutes, every U.S. president since World War II would have been hung. Now, making such statements, it seems to me, those statements shouldn't warrant any more objection than calling Mr. Milosevic or Saddam Hussein war criminals. Whether those statements are accurate, that's a separate question. If they're inaccurate, then the accuser is guilty of misrepresentation, recklessness, or libel. But issues of incivility don't or shouldn't, in my opinion, don't or shouldn't enter the picture. Or take another example. To accuse a professor of being a plagiarist or a falsifier of documents, that, in my view, is not an ad hominem argument, attack on the person. Those terms are defined as academic crimes and misdemeanors, which can be verified as true or false. It's as absurd to call that charge ad hominem when leveled against a professor as it would be if a student were to come to your office, you were to accuse the student of plagiarism, and he or she would take offense on the grounds that that's an uncivil ad hominem accusation. Well, that wouldn't carry much weight in any academic department. It's a factual question. You can be wrong or right, but it raises, in my mind, no questions of civility. Or a third case, if you accuse Jewish organizations and lawyers of turning the Nazi Holocaust into a blackmail weapon, or accuse a professor at NYU Law School, such as Bert Newborn, of being a Holocaust huckster, in my opinion, that's not an ad hominem argument. It's a factual question. Are people making money off of or exploiting the Nazi Holocaust for financial gain? I see no questions of civility arising in those examples. Now, there is another case. Statements which are plainly uncivil, but in my view, the circumstances warrant such incivility. Now, again, a caveat, a qualification. When I refer to incivility here, I'm not referring to incivility against the poor and the powerless, the humble, the hungry, and the homeless. I see no virtue whatsoever in kicking someone who's already down. But I do see there can be a value to being uncivil against those who wield power and privilege. So, for example, some of you may remember, because I see more oldsters than youngsters in the room, or let's say a fair balance, that during 1980s, Professor Chomsky wrote a wonderful little book called Turning the Tide on the U.S. Wars in Central America, and probably his most quoted line in the book, and maybe the best known line he's ever written, was when he described UN Representative Jean Kirkpatrick. He described her as, quote, the chief sadist in residence of the Reagan administration. Actually, whenever I meet people from that era, it's the one line we like to savor. And I think young people in particular yearn for a revered authority to speak the impolite and impolitic truth, and to give expression to the moral indignation that they, young people, feel, and that in fact is warranted by the occasion. There are moments that might require breaking out of the constraints of polite discourse to sound the alarm that innocent people are being butchered while we speak due to the actions of our government. Such incivilities should not be a substitute for reasoned thought. And no one will accuse Professor Chomsky of failing to argue his case or footnote it. But such a cry of the heart can also, in my opinion, fall within the bounds of legitimate discourse. It's also for me a question to wonder, why is the polite, witty, or learned put-down that is a staple of academic life, why that should be preferred over the incivility of language? So let me quote to you an example I found pretty compelling. There's this fellow at Harvard, I don't particularly like him, but, you know, sometimes people I don't like say things which are intelligent. So Henry Louis Gates, he gives two examples of, or two illustrations of what you might say to a young black student at Harvard. The first one goes like this, the polite, clever, witty response. Levon, if you find yourself struggling in your classes here, you should realize it isn't your fault. It's simply that you're the beneficiary of a disruptive policy of affirmative action that places underqualified, underprepared, and often under-talented black students in demanding educational environments like this one. The policy's egalitarian aims may be well-intentioned, but given the fact that the aptitude tests place African-Americans almost a full standard deviation below the mean, even controlling for socioeconomic disparities, they are also profoundly misguided. The truth is, Levon, you don't belong here, and your college experience will be a long downhill slide. That's Professor One. Professor Two says, out of my face, Jungle Bunny. And then Gates makes, which seems to me a perfectly reasonable comment. He says, quote, surely there is no doubt which is likely to be more wounding and alienating. I personally see no reason to prefer sophisticated insults that, as Gates shows, can be more vicious and hurtful than uncivil language, and that in their cleverness and wittiness are more often than not, and here I speak about people like Christopher Hitchens, testament to an self-indulgent verbal pedantry and lack of moral seriousness. Then there's the case of the ridiculous, who in my opinion are deserving of ridicule. If in the case of a touted academic or moralist, what appears to be profundity is really theatrics, charlatanry, or reliance on academic pedigree, then there is a time-honored tradition of exposing this fatuousness and shouting that the emperor is naked, especially if the mystification or scholarly credential is being used for pernicious purposes. And I think Mr. Elie Wiesel falls into the category of theatrics and charlatanry, which deserves to be called for what it is and which is used for pernicious purposes. There's also the case, in my opinion, of the double standard that's often used in this debate. So people like myself, the squeaky folk, are accused of being uncivil in academic life. But then you have distinguished people, people who hold university chairs. And they'll write a review in the New York Times Book Review of, say, the Holocaust industry. And this distinguished professor, university chair at Brown University, he describes the book, The Holocaust Industry, as, quote, bizarre, outrageous, paranoid, shrill, strident, indecent, juvenile, self-righteous, arrogant, stupid, smug, fanatic. And then he goes on to paragraph two. So the question arises, why is this sort of language permissible when used against dissenters, but when dissenters use comparable language against mainstream figures, it becomes a problem of incivility? In my opinion, for what it's worth, this sort of incivility is permissible, although it becomes unserious, which is something very different, if the ad hominem attacks are not supported by or become a substitute for reasoned argument. If all I did in my books, if all I did was hurl uncivil epithets, yes, I think I would be deserving of being called unserious. But if that were all I did, it would be hard to explain why the world's leading scholars in the field, Raoul Hilberg, calls my work a breakthrough. And then there's the problem, which Mr. Ullman in the audience will understand as well as, and perhaps better than anyone here, the problem of an academic who tries to address multiple audiences. That's because scholarship is often situated on the borderline between the civility of the ivory tower and the tempestuousness of the public arena, because the author is trying to reach two different audiences. But in my opinion, there's no necessary contradiction between a solid scholar meeting the most demanding standards of academia and a pugnacious scholar who has jumped into the public brawl. You can be both a pugnacious scholar in the public brawl and a first-rate scholar by academic standards. And the reason I mentioned Professor Ullman, because the classic example is, of course, Karl Marx. When Marx finished Das Kapital, he writes a letter to his comrade Engels, and he says, with some justice and pride, he says, it's a triumph of German science and scholarship. Notice, he's taking pride in it as a work of scholarship, as in a great German tradition. But then you open up this triumph of German scholarship and science, and everybody, except for a handful of economists, he hurls ridicule on. Just in the first pages, I was turning the pages, Mr. Bastiat is a dwarf economist. He refers to Mr. Rocher's eclectic professorial twaddle. He refers to Mr. Gannell's miserable work. He refers to the absurdity and triviality of the view adopted by J.B. Say. And then even people who I like, who I greatly admire, he saves the most vicious insults for them. So it's always pained me to have to read these pages. But when it comes to John Stuart Mill, it's probably his most famous put-down in Das Kapital. He says it's very elegant and subtle, but that makes it even more brutal. He says about Mill, quote, on a level plain, simple mounds look like hills, and the insipid flatness of our present bourgeois is to be measured by the altitude of its great intellects like Mill. It's very clever, but it's also quite vicious. Does that mean that Das Kapital is devoid of scholarly value? There are very few people, and you'd have to be really an imbecile to make that claim. So I conclude on this note. When you consider that our best universities eagerly recruit indubitable war criminals like Mr. Kissinger, Ms. Kirkpatrick, and now Mr. Rumsfeld, when you consider that many professors were involved in all sorts of sordid labors during the Vietnam War, when you consider that professors at our best universities advocate torture, the automatic destruction of villages after a terrorist attack, when you consider all this, it becomes clear that the question of civility, whether one treats his or her critics according to Emily Post's rules of etiquette, however real these questions are, and I think they are real, I don't want to dispute that, but however real they are, it is by comparison a meaningless sideshow or just a transparent pretext for denying a person the right to teach on account of his or her unpopular political beliefs. Thank you.
Norman Finkelstein. Our next panelist is Michael Stephen Smith, a New York lawyer, human rights activist, and author or editor of 6 books, most recently, The Emerging Police State. He co-hosts Law and Disorder, a radio show produced at WBAI in New York.
4 years ago, I edited the selected speeches and writings of our great attorney and fighter for democratic rights, Bill Kunstler. And I decided, and I wasn't comfortable with this, kind of edgy, you know, but I decided I would take the chance. And in 2004, I entitled the book, The Emerging Police State. Is that an exaggeration? And did I overstate it? Last month, Daniel Ellsberg, who is a great hero of ours, the person who released the Pentagon Papers and personally accelerated the end of the war in Vietnam, said that as he was collecting his thoughts one morning, it dawned on him that the coup in America had taken place. I believe that that's true, not to say that you can see it. The fist hasn't come out of the glove. But Ellsberg said that all it would take, and I agree with this, is some sort of precipitating event to get that fist out of the glove. Let's say Atlanta, Georgia runs out of water, or there's another terrorist attack, or somehow they get inveigled in another war, say, against Iran. That could bring about very bad consequences of the laws and practices that have been put in place since 9/11. 9/11 handed the repressive ruling elites in this country their program on a silver platter. It began with, a week after 9/11, Congress's authorization for the use of military force. And this allowed Bush, 9 weeks later, to issue, and this is the turning point, in my opinion, to issue what is known as Military Order Number 1. This was the coup. Michael Ratner, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is an organization that I work with, wrote the following on the anniversary of this order 2 months ago. He said, I remember thinking to myself that there had just been a coup in America, perhaps an exaggeration, but nonetheless a watershed moment in a country that I still thought had some semblance of a democracy and of the principle that the president was responsible to the law. As most of you may not recall the order, let me remind you that there are three key elements in it. First, the president claimed the authority to capture, kidnap, or otherwise arrest any non-citizen, and it was later extended to citizens, anywhere in the world, including the United States, who the president believed was involved in international terrorism, and hold them forever without any charges, proceedings, or trial. Amazing. A person could be held forever just because the president wanted them to be held. He took on the power to disappear people. Second, the order did provide that if, and if is the crucial word here, if the person was tried, there never needed to be a trial, but if the person was tried, such trials were to be held by a special ad hoc court called a military commission. And these commissions had no resemblance to a regular trial court. The entire proceeding could take place in secret with evidence from torture, and those found guilty could be executed in secret. Third, to the extent that names of these imprisoned people could be found out and lawyers found to represent them, no court could hear any case. Habeas corpus, gone. This order embodies within it the violations of fundamental rights we are now facing today. Indefinite detention without trial, Guantanamo, secret sites, special trials, and disappearances. While it does not mention torture, that appears to come later, a secret detention system is part and parcel of a torture system. Let's also repeat, this was a military order in a society and country that was still or purported to be under civilian rule. And this order, more than anything, indicates our loss of liberties. Well, you could call the coup a rolling coup. And I'm going to give you a number of examples of what I'm talking about. Let's start initially in the year 2000. And Mark may address himself to that, with the initial seizure of the presidency by stopping the vote count in Florida. Start there. How about the global doctrine of global superiority and advocacy of permanent war in Iraq? And now they've got a resolution through Congress saying they can Bush can go to war against Iran on his own. Repudiations of treaties like the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, refusal to recognize international law or the applicability of the Geneva Accords, roundup of immigrants after 9/11, people held without charges, the September 13th granting of open-ended authority to the president, of course, the domestic establishment of deployment domestically of the military as law enforcement agents. That's been illegal since 1848 with the Posse Comitatus Act. That's been revoked. Bush can take the National Guard from State A without the permission of the governor and put them over in State C without the permission of that governor and use them. He can also use private armies like Blackwater or Khaki. That's a new thing. Secret deportation hearings. Seizure of citizens as enemy combatants. The effective end of habeas corpus. That had been around since the year 1215. Massive secret wiretaps in violation of the FISA law. That's out the window. Issuance of secret administrative warrants for all kinds of records. Sneak and peek. They can come into your house, take stuff and not tell you. They could get your medical records, Patriot law, government records, and so on. You'll never know it. Suppression of Muslim charities. Classification of most governmental records. As a result of the struggles of the 60s, you know, the theory was our governments, democratic governments, so any documents that they produce are our documents. And under Freedom of Information Act request, you can get them. Not anymore. Attorney General Ashcroft said to the government, bureaucracies, don't give any more information out. And if there's a lawsuit, I'll defend you. You can't get this information anymore. Legitimation of torture. We have the current Attorney General, Mukasey, says he doesn't know whether waterboarding is torture. Rumsfeld says, torture? It's a no-brainer. Waterboarding, no-brainer. The assertion of executive supremacy through signing statements. A law will be passed by Congress, comes in front of Bush, and Bush says, well, I'm going to enforce this part of it, but not that part of it, because I don't like it. A signing statement. Bush has issued more signing statements than all the other presidents in American history combined. Expanded use of recess appointments. Bush's doctrine of the unitary executive, where the executive is over both the Congress and the judiciary. They've spent $385 million given to the corporation Kellogg Brown and Root. It's a subsidiary of, what's the name of it, Mitchell?
Halliburton.
Kellogg Brown and Root. And they've built a huge detention camp. And when they did it, they said, this is just not for illegal immigrants. So what to do? Liberals will tell you, don't worry. The Democrats are going to get elected, and the pendulum is going to swing back. That's hogwash. It's not going to swing back.
Here, here.
And whoever sits in the presidency is not going to give up the powers that they've been granted. It's not going to happen. Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. So what to do? Exactly what you folks are doing. Learn about this stuff. Educate yourself. And go out and organize. Because social change in this country doesn't come from the top down. And there's going to be no savior on the top. It's going to come from the bottom up. That's been the lesson of American history. It comes from the bottom up, from people like us organizing ourselves and making that demand. There's one thing you can think about and focus on, and that's the upcoming
military commission trials in Guantanamo. They've taken six of these guys now, and they've picked them out, and they're going to try them, and they want to execute them. Partisan use of the death penalty is a long tradition in this country. Clinton, for example. Clinton was campaigning when he was running for president the first time, and there was a moron, you know, a person with an IQ of like 60, who was on death row in Arkansas, Ricky Ray Reed. Clinton interrupted his campaign to fly back to Arkansas to preside over that execution. Ricky Ray Reed is in prison, and they say to him, "What do you want for your last meal?" He said, "Well, I want some fried chicken, and I'd like some French fries." He said, "What about dessert?" He said, "I'd like some chocolate cake, but I'll save that till afterwards." And Clinton has this guy executed. There's a word for that. Bush knew better. There was a gruesome murder by a young woman, teenager, named Carla Faye Tucker in Texas when Bush was governor. Bush is not running for president, and he's on one of the TV late-night talk shows. Carla Faye, meanwhile, is 10 years older. She's found religion. She's actually married her minister. She's facing the electorate chair in Texas, and she's asking that her death sentence be commuted and she be allowed to serve out the rest of her life behind bars. Bush gets on national television and he mocks her. He goes, "Boo, boo, 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 don't kill me." She says, "Please don't kill me." And they execute her, the first woman executed in hundreds of years in this country. They use the death penalty. They are going to use these military commission trials in Guantanamo and the death penalty for partisan political purposes. I predict that you're going to see John McCain running on that ticket. And they're going to try to stir up public support. These are the worst that are worst, and let's execute them. The evidence they've got against these people are hearsay evidence. It's evidence based on torture. Two of these people have been waterboarded. Waterboarding has been used to torture people since the Inquisition. It's been used in the United States, and people who have done it have been sent to prison because they did it. Now they're re-examining waterboarding. It's not torture. It's a no-brainer. They're going to use the torture-obtained evidence to terrorize the world, to execute these people, and to use fear to get a Republican elected. What's Obama going to do? I don't know. He sidestepped the question so far. He wasn't present in Congress for the vote. He wasn't present in Congress for vote on the revocation of the FISA law with secret wiretapping either. They don't want to take it on. They don't want to take it on because they don't want to be seen as soft on terror. Or maybe they don't take it on because they agree with it. The Democrats were the handmaidens of all this repressive legislation and practice. They went along with it. Several of them opposed it, but not that many. Not that many. They're still not doing it. And you don't have a public discourse. And all the things that I've just listed here, you don't have that discussed by the leading presidential candidates. It's people like us who are going to discuss it. It's people like us who are try to do something about it. Thanks very much.
Michael Stephen Smith.
I would now like to welcome to the podium Ms. Lynn Stewart.
You know, in one of the early emails I received about this conference, which is entitled Freedoms at Risk, someone had waggishly attached to it, "Is this conference too late?" And I think part of our answer is we're listening to Michael Smith, and we're listening to where the country has moved to, and some may say it is too late. But of course, we dyed-in-the-wool activists, leftists, believers say it can never be too late, because it is always time to organize, it is always time to fight back, it is always time to resist. I, of course, have a very personal stake in it. I stand before you tonight, and for those of you who don't know me, I am the lawyer who was convicted of aiding a terrorist organization for doing the work that I believe a lawyer should do. I had a client, I defended him, and I aided him. I did not aid his cause. Nonetheless, I was convicted of that crime in a federal courthouse about a mile south of here, and I'm before you today, free on bail, pending appeal. I have been on the streets for 6 years, which says something about how seriously the government even deals with this case. that I, if I am a dangerous aid to terrorism, that I am still walking the streets. But that beside the point, I have a very personal stake in swinging the pendulum back, in making change, because as long as I can stay out, as long as nobody is ordering me to the gates of a federal prison, I think we can change things. I think we can push things toward change. I don't know if any of you are as disappointed. I mean, I know I always live in hope. And when the Democrats got elected clearly on an anti-Willard ticket the last time around, and they actually had the majority in Congress, I said, okay, now we can do something. And what did we do? Nothing. Nothing at all. Impeachment. The first day, Pelosi took it off the table. All the political solutions are not available to us, and they're not available because people, politicians, are afraid, just like the rest of us are. People are afraid. But it's time to become unafraid, because we have to be more afraid of what's happened to us than of what might be out there. So I want to say that it is a very personal issue for me, because when people say, well, the Patriot Act, nothing's happening, you know, they're not out there arresting people and putting them in camps, I say, well, they arrested me. That's enough for me. And I also say, and many, many of my Muslim friends were, quote, disappeared. By that I mean they were taken to jail. They never were seen back in their communities in this country again. Many of them elected, quote, to be returned to their home countries. Many of them crowded the buses going north to Canada before they were deported. So, yes, it does have an effect. And even though our media does not really keep us informed, I'm sure that's no surprise to any of you, the fact of the matter is, insidiously, we are a very different country today than we were before 9/11. Some people may say, well, that's a good thing. I remember my son-in-law, who's blonde and blue-eyed, captain of the Colgate football team. His mother, who's tall and blonde and blue-eyed like him, after 9/11, said, I don't care if they search me. I don't care what they do. They can come to my house. They can do everything as long as it protects us. He said, Mom, they're not going to come to your house. They're not going to come and stop you in the airport. You're not the target of this. You're going to go right on living the way you always did. It's my wife, our daughter, Ralph's and mine, who is an interracial child. It's Zena who is going to get stopped at the airport. The boot is going to be borne by those who fit their profiles, their need to repress. So I think that is very important, that most Americans will not feel this yet, but they will ultimately feel it. I want to say that I never thought I'd live in a country where we have, as Michael puts it, offshore penal colonies where people are tortured and then are placed on trial with the product of that torture. You know, it's been a rule in this country that you can't even use a tactics that force people to speak, even if those tactics have nothing physical and are not mental duress. You can't do a thing like get someone to talk without being advised of his rights. And yet we are willing to say we will take confessions made under torture which are worthless. And any psychologist will tell you that. Anybody legal will tell you that. And this is where we are. I also want to say to you that I've talked to you mainly here about the legal profession, of course, because that's me. That's the law. That's what I was. I'm disbarred as a result of my conviction, but it's where my heart is, and it's what I know best, and it's what I want to talk about. And I want to talk about some people because we have very, very short memory in this country, very short. We don't remember the people who stood up and were victimized and then... Where are they today? Oh, yeah, I remember that. There was a young woman named Jesselyn Radich She was in charge of the United States Justice Department ethics. They passed on things before they did things. And when they asked her, can we interrogate John Walker Lind? He was captured, if you remember, in the spring after 9/11 on the battlefield in Afghanistan. Can we interrogate him? Not saying torture and just talk to him. She said, no, because he's got a lawyer. This is black letter law in this country. If you have a lawyer, you can't have, the cops don't talk to you. And then when this country acts like they are cops, although they're in military garb, they can't talk to you. She advised them, no, you can't. Well, of course, they went ahead and talked to him anyway. They went ahead and got all sorts of statements out of him anyway. They then appeared in court and said that it had been, I believe they said it had been okayed by the Justice Department. And then Ms. Radich went public and said, I personally wrote them. I have the file. I have the correspondence. I'm releasing it to the press. They were told not to speak to Lind. Well, of course, you know, she got her walking papers. She not only got her walking papers from the Department of Justice, they also, in traditional, I must say, a Bush pattern, is she couldn't get a job because what they said about her made every law firm in Washington say, not us, we're not hiring her. So Jesselyn was out on a limb because she had stood up and done the right thing, because she had revealed to a court. And all the whistleblower laws in the world aren't going to help Jesselyn. There's only one thing that's going to help Jesselyn, and that's mass movement. Because that's how things change in this country. They don't change only because a lot of people get a good idea and then we vote for a candidate and that candidate does our will and changes things. That may have been true a long time ago. I'm not sure it was ever true. When I read about that the Declaration of Independence was basically signed because the slaveholders thought it might be necessary to protect their interests since England was about to abolish slavery, then you say to yourself, all those great words, all that beautiful rhetoric, the pursuit of happiness. So you have to really examine very, very carefully all of this. I think that one of the most pernicious places that we now look at today is this new spate of thought crimes. And by that I mean the crimes, the law under which they have prosecuted the eco-terrorists, and I use their term, not my term. My term would be Friends of the Earth. And the way that they have done that, and they, of course, have declared that these are the most serious terrorists in our country today, which makes me sort of sad in a way, because we once had real political terrorists out there. Now we don't even have that. But at any rate, the eco-terrorists are sort of getting the nod from the government. And they are being prosecuted for really what is in essence thought crimes. They are a recent conviction in New Jersey by an animal rescue group. The animal rescue group that never rescued an animal. All they did was picket in front of labs that used animals experimentally. But they seized the website. And on the website, as one of their lawyers said at the Guild convention, was a piece. It was tongue-in-cheek, and it said 40 ways to be a terrorist. And it was a joke. It was like one of those things you get in your email, you know, and you say, ha, 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 and you delete it or you don't delete it or you send it on to 100 friends. But it was not serious. But these guys don't have a funny bone. They don't see things the way you and I might see them. And so they must have shown this to the jury in that case 50 times. And one very, very serious thing that was introduced that I didn't learn in evidence at law school, and I'm sure Michael didn't either, was this notion that a person can come in and it's part of the government's proof that this person was afraid of the defendants.